My son graduated. Oh, they should be. Okay, what kind of problems do you see the students now face in Caribbean?
A lot of peer pressure gets more complex than we end up with in terms of gender, drugs. The drug of choice when I was in high school was alcohol. The marijuana was a little tiny bit of it around, but it was, it wasn't a problem. Now, drugs and alcohol are not much more in the childhood than games, that pressure and is kind of involved with them. There's a certain romance about him or something, and he talks about it a lot, and the tough times and then the racial thing. It's kind of upsetting to me that most of his friends are Hispanic, and there's these pockets, racial pockets, that Hispanics don't like the Filipinos, the Filipinos don't like the Spanish, they don't like the whites, they don't like the other Asians or something. When I was in school, it was basically Natives and Caucasians, and then there's always a few Filipino people, and we never really looked at each other as different. We didn't know anything.
Could you perhaps close up some ideas of what or where you think it might be coming from? Because I assume that there was lots of Filipino food during the time, the drug was good.
Not really a lot. Most of them were Navy kids. The Navy was good. If anybody was on the bottom rung, it wasn't the kids of Asian extraction, it was kids of being Native. If somebody made racial slurs, it was against Native people. There were one or two black kids in the school, but never any more than that. So they weren't viewed as a whole lot different. We knew they were different color and stuff, but they were enough. There wasn't enough for them to be a racial identity, so they mixed in with the rest of us. There wasn't any more.
Okay. Did you probably notice too? I was going through the list that were already done the interviews for Dungeons or other classes that Gary had, and oil business has never been one that has been interviewed or brought up. I said, this is a big thing here in Alaska. Nobody had even thought about that. So I think it's really fascinating to understand how this is coming about the business. Who did your family start the business in
1950?
Was it here in Cordia?
Right here.
Now, when you, I assume it's your father who started it?
No, my grandfather.
Oh, really? So how how did he start the business? How did he transfer
it? It was Union Oil Company he was the first Union Oil Company distributor in Korea. They called the companies back then. And Union Oil had a contract to service aviation gas to several airlines all over Alaska. They had to be able to provide it in all the locations in the place of Kodiak, so they decided to put a Kodiak out so they could service the contract. And they lost the contract after just a few years, and the tanks, most of the tanks are original. A couple of our buildings are original for most of the years. And part of the dock structure, everything on it. Everything you see here is built on steel, which is always about a commodity that we have in
During the 50s, where did you get the supply and how were your supply transported?
Until 1960, 1978, Union Oil supplied the plant out of California tankers. There are five-minute ship that would come in on a regular basis. And by the time I started working here, I kind of monthly, we had to get a tanker in. So it was quite a lot of California.
Is there that most of the structures that you have here are the regional ones? I gather there was the great tsunami that came from before. Was any of the structure
The building you see there, the building at the garage, the corrugated metal buildings, were built on a dock. This was on the dock, and the water came in and filled it, and then it tore the decking off, and the building pulled it up and down. And back then, the liquor tanks didn't come around. They just came in and just bulldozed it and down to pick it up. But back then, the value of salvaging the buildings was still there. They were going to salvage the buildings, brought in fill, and then put fill in on the injury.
What about oil spill? Did you have any?
That wasn't even an issue back then. If you drained a hose or something, you just drained it into the water. That became an issue. You couldn't do things today that you could do.
So basically, you say that there is no federal regulation as far as
environmental stuff happened in the early 70s. I started working when I was going to college. I started working in 1971. But I didn't start full time until
1975.
So we didn't worry about stuff. I remember a spill off of a tanker and it was happening about 72. And we had to try and clean it up with this
guy. What sort of like a guidelines, I would imagine, in 1971, if it's environmental, if you've already formed a group, they must have some sort of guidelines, although not as specific as the ones that we have now.
I don't know what the guidelines were. You weren't supposed to get any oil in the water, and if you did, you were supposed to get in trouble. That's the way it was with 75 or so.
Did they impose any type of fines?
No. They were kind of slapped on the wrist, but I only remember the one incident, and it was
When you're talking about oil spills, then I would imagine why it's not as great as the ones that we have nowadays. So, in comparison, would you consider them as minor incidents?
Before?
Yeah.
No, people would indiscriminately spill. And I remember working here in the college and stuff, and guys would put the hoses in and they just sort of bring coffee, and we'd go by and there's food going all over the place, and you'd get a chef to hold off and yell out and they'd come out. And they'd be angry for that. They'd do all down in the water and they didn't have to pay for it. Nobody can have much of a concern until the first part comes and if you didn't have to go in and play with that and everything.
Do you think that could have added to some of the patients of comic fish?
Not at all, because the years after that were some of the biggest years for crab and shrimp and they weren't that big. It would be 50 to 100 gallons or something like that. Could have happened. It wasn't there. That's how much the attitude has changed now. It's pretty much easy to tolerate.
Is it because of the strength of the environmental foods, or is it because finally they're feeling the effects?
Well, no, I think it's the effects that are issues related to the laws and there's people to enforce them. Before there wasn't anybody to enforce them. When the Exxon tank was the law, that triggered all of this stuff. Big oil process, little oil losses.
Oh, yes, matter of fact, that's my next one is the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Now we are all aware about the effect that is on the environment of the wildlife as well. Now, what kind of pressure can you say there is to the environment of vehicle vaccinations carried on oil companies now?
There's kind of. The crude oil side is big oil, like molten sugar on the big names that you recognize. And refined oil has become smaller companies now. In the scope of things, we're one of the small companies in Alaska now. We do have those plant companies like Special Marine and something like that. They're getting to be larger, but we still share the same common problems of not an unlimited amount of time. And after the Exxon, the state of Alaska and the federal government passed all of these laws to make sure that that couldn't happen again, and to do all these things to these big oil companies, well, you know, that's what they just said oil, you know, and so we're living with a lot of things that had we probably would have gotten here eventually, but it would have been much more organized and much more directed to our exact needs, and it could have been done rationally. And there's some real horrendous demands put on us that we're trying to fulfill now, and kind of getting
it. What kind of changes that you, as in your own group, would like to see? You said there's a lot of pressure, there's a demand that might not be even related to your
They're probably kind of hard to explain to somebody outside the industry. One of the things we have to do is we have to put an impermeable liner around all of our tanks. So if we run a tank over, or a tank breaks, it's not going to come in the ground. But when you get into a wreck, the chances of us running the tank over are fairly slim. It's a definite possibility. But we put in this liner around there, and now water seeping through the ground will kind of handle a lot of the rainfall. Now we're going to have to catch rainfall and manage, you know, 1 to 2 million gallons of water a year that's going to be collected up there. Things like that. Those are the kind of issues that we're facing. A lot of equipment upgrades to prevent spills.
How often do you have to double check and see if your equipment are up to par with the
We have a schedule that we set up, and we're supposed to check on spill, you know, our spill equipment so many times a year. We're supposed to do some wet drills a year where we actually put a boat in the water and pull it around and physically do stuff, and so many kind of dry drills where we just get in the office and say, well, this happened, what are we supposed to do when people are right on the
spot? So that's all this training?
We do it, or we bring somebody in. We do most of it ourselves. Most of it's just common sense. It's, you know, we just have to spill off the dock, what are we going to do? We've all done the drill.
Do you provide some sort of training to the personnel that goes to handle the fuel and how do they get that?
Yeah, we provide that. Yeah, most of the training when something like this is on the job.
So you don't have, like to say, every year they need so many hours?
Yeah, that's the environmental type stuff.
Do they need to be certified?
There's a certification called HAZMAT for hazardous material workers.
We're running very fast on this one. I wonder if I could fill out my 10 pages here. Okay. hypothetical scenarios. There's oil spill in Kodiak, as big as that one in Prince William's town. Let's say it's your company who... Okay, just by saying it's a hypothetical question. What would you do?
Terminal discharge and prevention contingency plan and the EPA response plan of discharge. It's all three government agencies required that to put it together. We basically pull that off the shelf, open it up, and it tells us who we're supposed to call, what we're supposed to do, and all that. It's about 250 pages.
Do we have the personnel in the area that will have a quick response?
We have an operating agreement with Petra Marines, and one of us has a problem that we're responding. So that doubles our force. There are a few other things that are going on. We belong to what's called Alaska Shadoo. And
where's the base for that?
Shadoo, the office is in Anchorage.
How do you spell that?
It was formed by the oil transport, refined oil transporters in the state because we need to have coverage in order to transport oil, and then Kodiak Oil Sales, which is non-transported, probably about $80,000 worth of equipment, 80 or 100,000, maybe more than that, of equipment right in Korea. Two 40-foot band lines are filling the pumps, two response vessels. That's in addition to the resources that Kodiak Oil Sales and the Petroleum Services. So we have the capability and equipment-wise of a pretty good response on water response. We did a drill last year, and we had a hypothetical spill. We responded with our own personnel. While we were responding, we called Captain Marine and showed up with personnel and equipment and assisted our people. It was a joint drill. Right off of Lake Bob. And then Alaska Shadoo had brought in a team to help do training for us. And so we started our spill, we activated weather resources, and they were brought down. And within 1 hour of being in, it happened, we had three boats in the water, 20 people on the scene. I think 2,000 feet of boom in the water. We had the whole thing boomed out. I think it was less than we were prepared for it. We got another drill, same scenario with DPC. About 2 weeks later, it was an unannounced. And when they have an unannounced, they just tell you, in this month period, we're going to show up and you have to do it in the state.
And it's DEC?
Department of Environmental Conservation in the state. And we did the same drill with, we didn't deploy the bigger resources, but we did have Petra Marine respond and we surrounded the spill and had the cleanup underway in less than 35 minutes. The Coast Guard in DC were happy. They said we would have, next time you consider that the tide might be moving this way and you might want to do this. Those things aside, they were working.
How often do they do that?
You have an unannounced drill at least once every 2 years. And when they say an amount, they give you a month in which they're going to do it. And in my case, I was getting ready to kind of, trip or something. And so I called them up and they squeezed the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was going to be out of town at the beginning of the deal for about a week. And so they moved the deal up.
Okay, let's say they did the drill, mm-hmm. and you were out of town. Who's going to head it up?
Leading? We have other people designated in the plan that would be in charge. Having them at the women in the office know what they're supposed to do. Their job is to make calls and mm-hmm. do some observation. Some guys like to be in the boat, so they let the guys mm-hmm. do what they want to do, but everybody is, does enough training so they know how to run the boat.
So, 250 pages of
notes
you have?
Yeah, it's a big step. And that's partly because it's trying to satisfy three agencies, and there's a lot of stuff in there that we would never, that is required to have it. Discharge prevention and contingency. And in the plan, the outline improvements that were.
How often do they update their contingency plan?
Different agencies are different, but it's basically somewhere between 2 and 3%. EPA is way out there, in the States, 3 years. I think the EPA has a longer time frame because they know that the states are requiring that to move.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you now on the lighter side, I'm going to give you a little break. would you share some of the colorful stories about Kodiak? I think you've been here since forever, almost. just talking with some people, they say that there's a big change in Kodiak, maybe with more transportation, more people. What other things can you share?
Kodiak has changed. It's become a lot more civilized in the last 20 years, I guess.
What do you mean by civilized?
It used to be a lot more frontier spirit. The fishermen are always really independent. A lot of these guys, if they weren't doing this, they'd probably be in charge of a corporate, big corporation or something. A lot of them are that smart. They don't fit in that kind of a mold. They're real independent, risk takers, put their life on the line to, fight the weather and everything. And that's what they like to do. And it makes them different. They were a more uncivilized lot for me. 30 years ago, more bars than churches, and
uh-huh.
people were real rowdy, and preaching news and stuff, you go down in the bar, it was just different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more like a frontier type spirit, frontier character, and they were. And people that were here because they put the mold somewhere else, and so they came here, but they were a higher class or whatever.
What did they do for diversion?
Rowdy stuff. Now when you go down to the bars, are rowdy and stuff, or and uncivilized, they're really uncivilized. these people were just lovers of life and whatever. It's
okay.
A lot more frontier spirit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I know there are some physical changes in the area. Could you name some? Let's go back from the Great Tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Itself, how was it affected?
What once the water didn't pick out, it didn't remove the federal government from the building in the downtown. And so pretty much everything that was down there either washed away or torn down and replaced with more modern structures. And then Kodiak's kind of grown from there. When I was 13 years old, I remember going duck hunting, and a rabbit hunting up where Silly Plain was in. It was a lake there. And that was really getting out in the woods. It was going on to Spice Street.
Population wise, about how?
It was still 5,000 people.
So when did you start seeing the arrival of more people?
It's just been gradual. And just, it always amazes me that more people come here because we got seemingly less fish. We used to fish year round here after everything, and now seasons are days instead of months.
During those times when you have from tsunami too, was there a break in your service?
No,
people would still need oil.
I was